So, Kathy and is really, I guess, the only one on with a project.
Oh dear.
Well, Kathy, what we did learn, and I'm sure you've heard by now, is that there is an intent to publish. Oh, there's somebody.
Hey, it's me. How are you, Ed?
Good, Michael. How are you?
Very good.
Did you get to see the fireworks last night in Boston?
I didn't. I hung out at home, but I got to hear them.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, that's what I heard a lot here, but I didn't see any. I got to watch them on TV.
No, 1812 Overture, though. I couldn't hear that.
You had to turn TV on. I heard it.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it was good.
So the only person who has a project who's on, all the science advisory boards here and the informatics people are here, but we're missing Raj, who's moving labs today, Dan, who's on vacation, Fung, who we didn't hear from, and Tim Cudd, who we didn't hear from. But I was telling Kathy there's now an intent to publish an RFA for continuation of the CFAF.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good. The budget will be relatively flat. We're not expecting any big increases. We're going to kind of be at the same level. We have asked or started soliciting people who might be interested in joining CFAS. I think we've gotten a few inquiries, and I think Bill's gotten a couple. But I'm not sure if they're to join us or whether they want to try to write their own application. And that's kind of where we are. We expect that the application will probably be due sometime in December.
Mm-hmm.
For a review in the spring.
Okay.
So that will put a big chunk of your time, you know, for the fall will be in getting this ready.
Right.
As it will for everyone. But I did hear that you did a very nice job at teratology and you were missed at the RSA. And I wish these two societies would get together and stop trying to schedule everything at the same time.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, every year. It's exactly the same week every year. So, yeah, so when we do start seriously putting our proposals together, are we all planning to get our heads together to talk about how things can mesh and you know, so the clinical and the basic science really do complement each other and all of that?
Absolutely, and I think that's what, you know, we'll have to spend time on today, and I wish there were more people on who had projects so that we could discuss it, but I think we need to start seriously thinking about the renewal and how we're going to mesh projects and which projects are going to move forward as part of CFAS and which projects we think might be better served by going out and trying to make them R01s and spin them off as R01s. The things that I see short-term right now is we have to try to solicit applications, as we've done in the past, for the past renewal, to try to see or think about what cutting-edge science we think that CFAS could benefit from and hopefully invite those projects to consider being part of CFAS. That's, for example, you know, where Peter Hammond was invited in, and that's worked out very well. And to try to think of what's cutting edge, what's really going on in the field that we think by bringing them into the consortium would have better products in the long run. The other thing is that we also have to solicit developmental projects. I think that the developmental projects have been one of the areas that CFAS has done a reasonable job on, and I would like to continue those. And given the flat budget, I don't know whether they'll be at the level that they were in the past, but we've gotten fairly big bang out of our bucks for on some relatively small projects. And Bill and Dale and I think talked about some of these in Atlanta. So if there are projects that you think, you know, might be a little riskier but may have a high payoff and could integrate into the CFAS or by CFAS providing some initial support for these projects, they could spin off into R01s. If anyone can send me their names and the people, and I'll get in touch with them and ask them. I think we'll have to send out a general message to the FASD study group and the RSA to try to do that. Perhaps also ISPRA, since we are an international consortium. There are some people who have already expressed an interest in kind of perhaps submitting a pilot project to help them get going. So these have to be done relatively quickly because there's a review process that has to be undertaken. And so that will take some time, and then we'd still have to give time to people to write up those applications. So that's my short-term goals, is to solicit people who might be interested in joining CFAS, and you know, with the understanding it will be hard to knock off someone who's already in the consortium, but at the same time, I think we really need to try to make the consortium as productive and integrative as possible.
So have you already sort of surveyed the horizon to identify what you feel is the new cutting-edge science? So do you have a feeling for who you would like to include?
No. I'm after the RSA, I kind of went brain dead. And so, but that's on my agenda. I'm not traveling for the next 2 months, so I have a lot of time to think.
Okay.
So, Ed?
Yeah.
In terms of those developmental projects, are you thinking that they should be identified to be able to be incorporated into your administrative core application, or would they actually be reviewed by the peer review group?
What we've done in the past is we've solicited pilot project or developmental project applications. And in the first iteration of CFAS, there was a pilot project core. That just added a layer of complexity that we didn't need. So in the second iteration, we simply put the developmental projects into the administrative core. And that seems to have worked out very well. We solicit applications for the first 3 years of the renewal. And so these are 2 to 3 year projects. And then I appointed a review committee that John Hannigan chaired last time. And he put together a review committee, sent those out, and basically sent us the recommendations about what to include or not. And then we had Michael, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I think then we had a conference call, and we narrowed it down to the last time it was Rajesh and Claudia Tesh.
Sure. So, but are you hoping to identify the next wave of projects prior to submission?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, I think we would do better in a review than simply saying we want $300,000 for developmental projects.
Mm-hmm.
I think we would do better in the review if we said these are the projects that we've chosen for the initial couple of years and go from there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if other people agree or not. I mean, I think that we've had leeway in the past. I mean, Peter Hammond was funded a little bit out of pilot project money and a little bit out of administrative core carryover. Whitcomb in Australia was funded out of surplus pilot project funds that got there because we saved money on some FNA. I received an email from Peter Hepper over the weekend who said that he is, and he was funded with $10,000 from CFAS, and he is now resigned as chair and said that he's taking a sabbatical and he plans on writing up the work he did as a pilot project. He wanted to know the grant number so that he could cite it. So, you know, I think that the pilot projects work well, but I think we really need to go in with some idea of where we're what we're asking the review committee to fund. I don't know if people feel the same or differently or what.
I would about me? Chime in here, Ed. I was just on one of the INEA reviews, and the pilot projects were not named in that one, and I thought it was a mistake.
Okay. Yeah, I agree, Ed, that it makes sense to name the first pilot projects, but also to have an expectation that the pilot projects aren't going to be funded for more than a couple of years, and that an important component of the grant would be the ability to spawn additional pilot projects as we did. We have a track record we can point to, which is good. And if we show them the process that brings in the next round of pilot projects, they can decide whether or not this is a good process and whether we're getting good responses to our solicitations. But I would build in the idea that we would continue that process and continue to refresh the consortium by having people come in on pilot projects.
Yeah, I think one of the disappointments is that, I don't have any data. I'd have to go back and look at the pilot projects that were funded to see if we had spun off any R01s off of those. You know, there were several that were foreign sites, and I know that they don't because they typically don't come back in for NIH funding. But, you know, I'd have to put that information together, and I'd have to go back and look at the projects that we had finished. But, you know, I think we have to, in the future, I have to be more adamant about the pilot projects. Okay, here's the funding initially, but what we really want you to do is take the data that you collect in that pilot project, spin it off into an R01, and we always have the option of using those R01s and converting them to U01s and make them officially part of the consortium if they need the resources of the consortium.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I need to be more up on that, keep that more
so open. I think that's putting your finger on the key challenge in moving forward. It's demonstrating, again, what's really the advantage of having the consortium. I think Kathy had phrased it earlier, you know, looking for new projects that might be out there, basic or clinical. What's the advantage for them for joining the CFAS rather than going in as an R01?
Yeah.
And it'd be hard to demonstrate an advantage of having a developmental or a pilot project out of CFAS if it really hasn't generated R01s or UO1s.
Well, I think you can demonstrate it by the publications that come out of it, particularly for the foreign sites where the coming back in for an NIH application may not be as easy as it would be for the U.S. sites. But at the same time, you know, I have to be more assertive in turning those pilot projects into R01s. You know, if you get the funds, we're not just funding a study. We're funding a programmatic line of research that we hope develops by our initial funding of a riskier project.
What are the prospects of getting submissions, even if they're for R01s, even if they're under review while the CFAS is being reviewed? I mean, that would, you know, a submission would demonstrate success of the program. even if it hasn't turned around to be funded yet.
Oh, yeah. No, I think that would be fine. I think what we need to be careful of is with the electronic submission is that we don't – if a project's already submitted as an R01, if we include it in our application, it may catch it as a duplicate.
Well, I wasn't – no, I'm not implying duplicate. I mean, if it goes off as a separate R01, you still list that in your progress report as a success of the consortium.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
Even – you know, I even think that if it doesn't have to be a direct follow-up of the pilot data, but something from that group that, you know, maybe developed out of it. You know, maybe the pilot project wasn't successful, but – it in turn led to a new direction. I'm going to have to solicit from each of the former pilot project individuals, you know, what happened as a result of that, those funding. You know, what are the publications, what support, and did it develop into a more programmatic line of research?
Yeah, and I agree that even if it's in a different direction, that would still be a success.
Yeah.
And you might also inquire of the foreign sites, is if it's not an R01, I mean, is there other sources of funding that are continuing the program in the other sites?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. Or any other indication of a continued research program?
Yeah, I mean,
even
like,
if it isn't a funding source, I would think.
You know,
yeah,
the
good point.
Project was funded as a pilot project, and it had large ramifications in policymaking in Western Europe. And while there's still now a tremendous interest in following up on those kids, and the group that was involved in that project maintains their research activities in FAS. Now, they've now gotten some money from the Italian government to move forward on doing the follow-up of those kids that they initially saw, you know, 4 years ago. So, you know, I view that as a success, even though it didn't involve coming back for any more NIH funding. I think Ken and Peggy are, in fact, signing an agreement sometime during the next year with the Italians to foster more research in FASD in that area. So, you know, I view that as a success.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
in terms of the timing, though, of soliciting these in relationship to creating what projects are going to be in the main application, I mean, is that going to be a parallel process, or is it initially kind of figuring out the direction of the consortium and then choosing those pilot projects based upon not only their potential but their fit?
Well, yeah. I mean, what I think I need to do is to solicit them. And then while those people, they have to send in one-page type of things, we have to have it reviewed. And why that's going on is to look at what other applications we get for the main who come in as UO1s and then kind of see if there's some unifying theme. I've thought a little bit about unifying themes. You know, just Kathy's on the call, so I'll use her as an example. You know, I think the data that we heard at RSA as a result of the day 8.5 exposure periods producing a different face. And linking that up with Peter Hammond, I think that a tremendous amount could come out of that about developmental timing and the face of FAS. You know, there may not be a single face of this disorder. There may be different faces depending upon what timing of exposure. Knowing that, and I think then if we can take Peter's spatial stuff and link it into brain development, we might say, hey, you know, with exposure at this time, this is the types of behavioral or brain changes and therefore the types of behavioral changes that we see. So, I mean, I think that's you know, one of at least my thoughts right now. And I think that's a good example of how these projects can interrelate very well. And they've done a nice job of this already. I mean, you know, I have a list of publications that have resulted from the symposium And, well, maybe I'm getting off topic, but one of the things that we need is more integrative papers between the various UO1s and the pilot projects. You know, when you look down the publication list, there's just too many of them with only a single project that's cited. Well, not that there's too many of them, but there needs to be more where multiple projects have been cited. And I guess
I'd like to endorse that also. I think that I went through looking at, you know, the publication list, and I think there's room for coming up with something integrative among the sheep and the mice, both in Kathy's lab and Fong's lab. What can we draw in common among those, comparing it to the clinical as well?
Well, that's, you know, the other thing I have on my little list here of comments for today, and maybe Charlie would have some better input into this since he reviewed the INIA, is the publication and the progress that have been made on projects and how that influenced the reviewer's decisions. So Charlie was I had heard that projects that got in trouble were ones where progress wasn't all that clear.
Well, I'll make a couple of comments, general at least. I was only on the ones that INIA is, so I can't speak to the other one. But part of the issue was not so much the numbers of papers, but the actual discovery science and, you know, what advances had really come out of the consortium. And that was a lot of the discussion, you know, when you try to pinpoint down exactly what did this consortium produce that has changed the field or has set it off into a new direction, sometimes those answers weren't quite as clear as they should have been. And I think that's one of the things that the CFAS, you know, I think has the potential to do, but I think that's really emphasizing, you know, the new findings, the new knowledge that's been generated out of this integrative approach, and how it would, you know, how it sets up, you know, new discovery research for the next 5 years is really the, I think.
Well, then, you know, in the past application, each section had a common introduction that had to be included, and maybe that's what we want to consider for that common introduction. Is the field has advanced in these ways because of work that came out of this consortium. And it's to highlight that basically in the opening of every one of these applications.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good idea. I also think, at least in the review I was in, the administrative corps was given the opportunity to answer the question, and even then it wasn't fully answered. So I think highlighting it and emphasizing it, you know, along the way is a good idea.
All right. So Jill, remind me of that. All right. That's in that comment section that we have to put together.
Okay.
I think the comment section worked well the last time, and I think it's a good idea this time. But in addition, I think, you know, this is the common outcome that the consortium as a whole produced, and this particular project contributed in this way.
Yeah, and you know, they have to say that in their introduction for each of the projects. But, you know, last time each application had to have this common introduction that was the same. I mean, it was just copied and pasted.
Okay.
From one application to another, and we wrote that as a group. And that's probably what we'll do again this time is, you know, is to basically have everyone write their little piece about what their project has done to forward the field and how being a member of the consortium made it happen faster than it could have ever happened by itself. You know, and you know, there's, like, easy things. I mean, you heard Peter's talk in the facial imaging project. You couldn't do that at a single site. you know, so I think that that's been an advantage. The profile paper that Sarah did, I think with Kathy and Fung's thing, if they can put that together with the sheet model, that would be a real advance. So, you know, I think that can be done. I think the thing that, you know, I need to stress to everybody, and, you know, Kathy's really the only one on here, is that, but in the clinical projects, the basic science projects, that we just can't be collecting more of the same. And that's primarily probably the clinical projects, but I don't think we can simply go in and say, you know, we have 1,200 kids, we need 1,500. And we're going to continue doing what we do. I think that Faye put it one day at a meeting that we were having, is that we need news that we can use. We need to start taking this now into a more translational approach and okay, what have we found and how can we get it implemented? One of the things that I was thinking about doing, and I've talked to NIAAA about this, is, you know, there are these P50 projects and then there are P60 projects. And the difference between the two is that one has an educational component. I think one of the things that we need to do is to get ourselves out in the public eye a little bit better than we have. And, you know, we went to Canada. I give lots of talks where I always highlight the accomplishments of CFAS, and I'm sure we all do that. But I was thinking of trying to put aside a little bit of money to basically make a better educational component of CFAS. And, you know, I thought of ways to do this, either better online and a better website for the public with more information on it and things like that. And right now we handle the website, and maybe we need to get somebody who can really, you know, make it more dynamic, keep it updated with progress in the field and how we're contributing to that. The other thing I thought about was to, like, approach a group like NOFAS and ask if we could basically have regular meetings with them or involve them in our progress, or people could take their research, translate it into a couple PowerPoint slides that then Kathy Mitchell could take on, you know, the 150 talks she gives every year, and, you know, and kind of be our public advocate for CFAS. So that's another.
I would just want to comment. I think your ideas are of course very good. I think the issue here is not the need for this. There's a clear need. The issue is the scope and how much can be done, and is that the way the consortium wants to use, you know, its flatline resources. I personally think it's great, and you have, you know, a lot of talented people already involved that put an emphasis on education, Kathy, you and Michael, and so forth. But is it really the way you want to, the next phase? And it's, I'm raising the question only to raise the question, not to indicate an answer. I think it's a large task. And, you know, if you can slice out a piece that you think would make a difference, then it would be a good addition.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking of a tremendous amount of money. You know, this would be, I think for a P60, it's $100,000 is the difference.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't even thinking that amount.
I think that, of course, you know my bias here, but I think this is a golden opportunity to make an international impact. And I think sending Kathy Mitchell around with a few slides is a good idea, but it's a little dated. And I think that if, in fact, I mean, this is a group that's already been working internationally, and I think that the fact that we have international ties and international connections makes us unique, different from, you know, other things that can do an educational outreach. And I think that, in fact, we need to take take advantage of the word international. I think we need to get connected up with the other international health agencies that are out there in the world, like WHO or, you know, whatever, Save the Children, or, you know, just big outreach things that are already happening all around the planet, and get connected with them and make a big difference in the world, not just in our own little part of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And we are now connected to WHO, and the WHO has, at least in their, it's not a draft anymore, it's going on to human subjects approval, is utilizing part of the battery that was developed out of CFAS. For their neurobehavioral, they're using our dysmorphology forms, although they're adopting the Canadian criteria for diagnosis of FAS. And but I've been working with the WHO now in trying to put this project together that's going to be done in I don't know how many countries, and it's kind of a staggered approach, depending upon how much money each country wants to invest in this project. But it's nice to know that their initial draft did not include very much from CFAS, and their last draft, well, the one that's gone on now, includes a lot from CFAS. So that's good. But, we can, you know, try to do it. I'm not the best communicator in terms of or know the resources that are out there that we could utilize. I'm lucky I can find a web page, let alone design or try to get it out there. But I know you have a lot of experience in educational efforts online, so I'll take any help I can get.
It's Michael. I want to endorse the idea that we should have a larger profile and should seek an international audience for the work that we're doing. It can be costly to do this, both in terms of resources and people's time, but maybe one of the things that we should be brainstorming about as we plan for the renewal is exactly what shape this effort should take and what its goals should be. It becomes a practical matter as you're trying to get the budget to balance out, that at some point, in order to do this at a certain level, you do have to subtract from some other piece of the project. And I think if it's up for discussion at the outset, depending on the quality of the programs that we're recommending and the enthusiasm of the rest of the group for the proposal, it will stand on its own and probably compete appropriately for other things that we might do, because I think it does meet the intent of the RFP, and it's hard to imagine doing this work and not advertising it. We've tried to do that in the conventional way by putting symposia together for RSA and ISBRA. That's worthy, but it has limited reach. I think that in this era, there are ways of extending our reach well beyond those moments for the people who happen to attend them, beyond our publications, which are out there anyway and for which CFAS acknowledged in a footnote. There are things that could acknowledge CFAS in the masthead, in the letterhead, or on the front page of a website, and I think that it is important.
Yeah, and one reason that NOFAS came up is that NOFAS is now branching out internationally. Tomorrow I am doing a web chat that's sponsored by NOFAS, but it was initiated by SAB Miller. SAB Miller contacted NOFAS to identify someone who would answer questions online, and NOFAS asked me if I would do that. And so tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, I start answering questions. And it was advertised in the UK primarily, But so they are getting contacts with more international sites. They now have international representation in the UK through NoFash UK. So that's why their name came up, and as one possibility of doing this. But you know, we have to think seriously, because as you know, Michael and other people have said, we take away money to do this. That's something that we don't fund. So,
well, how much do we know about what's going to be in the RFA at this point? I mean, we're making some presumptions about, or are we making presumptions about what's going to be in there, or is there some foreword coming in?
I think it's going to be pretty similar to what it was last time. Bill, you, Dale, you can correct me on that, but
I think it's a pretty safe assumption to go by what was in the last RFA. And I do also want to point out that when you were talking about the comments section, I guess the last time around the applications were 25 pages, and this time around more than likely will be limited with the page limits that are the new page limits which have been established for UO1s and U24s, which I believe is 12 pages.
Mm-hmm.
So your amount of space.
Our comment section is going to be real small, huh?
Right. So I would push for concise sections and concise applications.
Did the last RFA include an education component?
No, I don't believe so.
No.
I think there's enough leeway in the RFA that it can get put in there.
Okay. I would think so too.
So, all right, any other issues? All right, so then in the next week or so, I think we're going to try to set up a regular conference call, and also to try to establish groups of integrative PIs that then could have conference calls themselves and discuss moving their projects forward. I'll send out things to RSA and to the FASD study group soliciting both pilot projects and projects that would want to come in. You know, that's where I see my time being spent over the next couple of weeks. But I think, you know, we've got to start having more regular calls and smaller groups of the PIs to develop and get these projects. Because if they're going to be due in December, you know, beginning in September, October, these projects have to be integrated, you know. And just as an example, the last time around, you know, Fung was reading Tim's project, and Tim was integrating into Fung's project, and Kathy as well. And, you know, people need time to do that. So I think we're at a critical time when we have to start focusing on getting the PIs together in smaller groups and defining those areas where we want to move the consortium forward.
Ed, when do we think the deadline will be for submission?
I'm thinking December. I have not heard. But
well, you said January when we were in Atlanta.
That's why I'm saying December.
I would say mid-December would be a good estimate.
So
in terms of a cycle of solicitations and reviews prior to submission for pilot projects or developmental projects, that needs to start pretty darn soon.
Oh, yeah, right away. I mean, I figured we'd get a notice out to the FASD study group, RSA, ISBRA, by the end of the week. That, you know,
on the flyer that we had at RSA, we put July 15th for the one-page deadline.
So, you know, and start getting those in and putting together an outside review committee to start looking at the developmental projects. And the reason we did that is last time is that some of the developmental projects came from people already involved in CFAS, either in the Science Advisory Board or whatever, and so we wanted an external independent review committee. And I thought it worked well. John, you did it, so I don't know where he went. John.
I'm right here. Sorry, yeah, I didn't.
Did you think did it work well? I thought it went fine.
Well, then it went fine.
The only other thing that I have been approached about, and I think might be a reasonable thing to include, is there are groups that would like access to our resources, not so much subjects, but our technical tools that we have put together that don't need funding. They're already funded, or they have government funding, but they would like in some way to be associated with CFAS. And these are usually sites in foreign countries. For example, there's the project going on in Australia. They've asked about being kind of an auxiliary. There's a site in Croatia, and the same is there. Scotland is starting a big FAS awareness campaign, and they've talked to me about somehow being involved. They're not asking for money. What they're asking for is that, well, we'd like to use your tools and also be a resource for the consortium in terms of maybe subjects and things like that. It might be hard to put it together in some formal way, but it's just another thing I thought I would throw out there, is to have these auxiliary sites where we're not putting any money into them. They're already funded.
I think if Scotland is starting an FAS awareness campaign, I think it might be a golden opportunity to hitch our wagon initially to that as sort of an example of how we then could get involved with prevention/awareness activities in other parts of the world as well.
Yeah.
They're asking us to be involved, we could start talking to them about how, in fact, they would like us to be involved to get started, and that could, you know, maybe even give us some pilot data for a prevention-type effort for the grant application.
Well, except we do know that prevention is going to be emphatically not part of this RFA.
When we're talking about education, isn't that prevention? What education? I mean, I don't understand.
Well, we probably are not going to try to set out and do a gigantic prevention trial, and that's because of the cost involved.
Okay, so you're talking about educating clinicians then?
Well, I see these sites, these auxiliary sites, as providing a resource for CFAS. So if we need to send a camera and we need, you know, another 30 pictures of somebody, we could send it off to Scotland and they'd be using our forms and everything. And so we'd have a general idea that we could get more pictures here, or we could allow them access to the camera and see what it comes out. But I think it also allows us to provide them with resources they may not have. Your educational component, things that you've learned in trying to go into the school system and educate people. And it would kind of be a service to these sites.
Okay.
I don't see us doing a big prevention trial, mainly because of the budget. Just the identification COFAS project going on in San Diego is $1.4 million a year, and we just can't afford that kind of budget. So
couldn't you do a public awareness thing that's web-based that isn't all that expensive?
Sure, we could. If something like that came in and the review committee thought that was a worthwhile endeavor, sure. But it would have to be somewhat unique because there are already lots of web-based campaigns out there. there. Some companies have had SBIRs to do that as well.
Well, one thing that you'd want to be unique in this is in, is as much as possible is featuring the research that you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But so I just
and I think that really gets to that issue of who what the target audience is that Kathy was bringing up. Is it going to be clinicians? Is it families with individuals with FASD? Is it the general population?
Yeah, well, that's the key question.
You have to remember that the funding comes from NIAAA, and NIAAA is, you know, has had a research mission. I think that they're interested in prevention research. I don't think that they're interested, well, I shouldn't say they're not interested, but they're not funding educational campaigns so much. Bill, Dale, comments?
Yeah, I think research is the focus. We translate the results of research into our own policies and communication tools. I think the thrust is definitely on the research.
But if we have an education component to the next consortium, if we make it a piece equivalent to a P60 instead of a P50, the point that in fact what you're doing is translating your research into education. Then do you have to, in fact, make that education component research again, or you're just translating your research?
We certainly support research on the implementation of that kind of information, but I don't know if that's, you know, it has to be that. It might be very valuable for someone to have a talk with Vivian Faden in our Science Policy and Communication Division. I'm sure some of you know her. I don't know this stuff off the top of my head, and she would.
All right.
I might be able to provide some good guidance.
Okay.
Put that on my calendar, Jill.
Okay.
You know, Ed, one question I had about these auxiliary sites is could you slant them in terms of educating researchers by providing, you know, the CFAS-derived tools as an education angle.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the example of that is Australia, where Ken Jones and Tina went there. They then came to that meeting in Vancouver, had long discussions with Sarah, or had discussions, I don't know how long they were, with Sarah and myself about the batteries that we were using. And what we're doing, and you know, we had made some recommendations. Some of them were used; others became impossible. For example, the CANTAB, there was just simply a cost factor that they could not deal with. But the Australian government's putting up all the funds, but the technical resources and diagnosis, etc., you know, fell on Ken Jones. So, yeah, it's that type of thing where he went over, he trained some positions there. So that's the type of thing I'd like to see. You know, I don't know what Ken's time is like. He has told me that he absolutely wants to partake in the next iteration of CFAS and have a dysmorphology core. I don't know whether I could get him to fly to Croatia and Scotland and do that type of stuff, the training, but we're bringing the guy from Croatia to San Diego. He's the government. The Croatian government's sending him here. He's going to spend a couple months training, both behavior and with Ken. So yeah, I think that that's part of what I would envision for these auxiliary sites.
So Ed, this might already exist, but it might not. But in terms of like resource sharing, I'm wondering if on the public CFAS site there are links like resources for clinicians, resources for researchers, where the forms that that can be shared can be made accessible, maybe with a CFAS logo on it, maybe with instructions, please cite CFAS,
That's,
you know, if
that's
you
a great
use...
idea. They are not on the public side of the website.
Mm-hmm.
They are behind the PI site.
Mm-hmm.
But people who have expressed an interest have been given access.
Right. And another thought along those lines, has Ken or Gene or others, have they ever put together a video of the dysmorphology assessment that could be posted, and maybe people can learn this without these people, you know, Ken and others, the few that you know have these skills, to be spreading themselves thin across the globe.
Well, we can talk about that on the clinical call. I would bet that Ken would say no, that wouldn't be possible.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it might be a good idea to have at least how it's done out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that there is always value. It may not be something that people want to depend upon, but there's always value in just a how-to. I just put up my hand exam on YouTube through the Brigham recently, and it's gotten about 400 or 500 hits. I think people really do benefit by seeing it, even if seeing it is not sufficient to give you the skill yourself. I think for people who are in other parts of the world who don't have access to Ken's expertise, and frankly, for posterity as well, I'd kind of want to have that.
Yeah. It just seems there is a bottleneck there, and any little bit might help.
Yeah, I think, and we can ask Ken, but I'm going to bet that he's going to say that it would create more confusion, but I think we can convert him. I mean, he used to think behavior was worthless, too, so he doesn't think that anymore. So. And, in fact, they're developing a PDA-assisted thing now for papilleal fissure size that's going to be implemented in Korea. So, you know, I think that they have resources that they could put out there to get, you know, to educate people as well as to put CFAS more on out in the public eye.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All righty. Well, any other issues, questions? I think we got our work cut out for us, and Jill will be sending you many, many more, many more emails.
Yeah. Well, one thing I would add, this is for the most part the SAB, I believe, not everyone, but should PIs be able to talk with the SAB on a one-on-one basis about what their ideas are for going forward? We make ourselves
absolutely. We are, you know, a fairly informal structural organization. So I don't think anyone, you know, has to worry about stepping on anyone's toes by talking directly to the SAB. You know, a more active SAB, because some of our members are not as active as a lot of us.
And I felt we made some progress with our conversation at breakfast at the meeting, but left feeling like maybe the SAB might be valuable for us to talk a little more.
Yeah, I mean, between the Science Advisory Board and NIAAA and myself, Michael,
yeah.
A little breakfast group.
Yeah.
So Jill can set up a doodle poll and find out some times.
Do people feel the same?
I agree.
Yeah, I thought it was very useful.
Yes.
I felt like another 2 hours and we would have had the whole thing solved.
Yeah. To our liking, maybe not to everyone else's liking. But,
right.
You know, because decisions are going to have to be made about, you know, projects that move forward and budgets that move forward. We have some very expensive projects. And there are some strategic issues that have to be considered because, you know, we changed, it's kind of a structural change between the first and the second, and some of them were positive, but not all. And we may need to reconsider how some of these projects are going to be structured or dealt with. And they're primarily not the basic science projects, but the ones that have, you know, 5 or 6 subcontracts on them, and some of the subcontracts have subcontracts, and it's just that's just unwieldy. It didn't work very well. So I think we need to, you know, have a conversation between the SAB and NIAAA, and perhaps a PI, to figure out better ways to allocate resources.
That sounds good.
Before we hang up, I have one thought that just popped into my mind. Do you know Kirsten Stromlund?
Yeah, very well.
So she was at the RSA meeting.
Yeah,
she's
sure.
Been doing a study in orphanages in Brazil. And I think she's really the only ophthalmologist on the planet, she and Marilyn Miller, that really care much about FAS. But just as you mentioned palpebral fissures, I mean, the fissures are weird because the eyes are weird. And I don't think enough attention has been given to the eyes. And I bet you that Kirsten would make a really wonderful addition to our consortium and could bring in a whole new continent.
Well, she has Brazil. She also has Estonia.
Yeah.
And Sweden.
Yeah.
So,
I just think maybe she needs, if you want to think about it and think about if maybe she could, you know, have a special consideration or something. I don't know.
She would be one of the people that, and Jill reminded me of this, that I will specifically ask. Consider the project.
Will do.
All right. I just reviewed a paper, though, on eye defects and not on vision in kids with FAS, and certainly a lot of them, according to this paper, 65% of them had referable ophthalmological issues.
Right. I mean, it's
but they were not predictive. That was the problem. Is that
they lateralize?
I'm just pardon?
Are they lateralizing visual defects? Because Kathy's work shows kind of lateralizing.
They basically were looking at contrast sensitivity, color vision. They did it was a battery of 6 or 7 visual tests.
Mm-hmm.
And basically there's a high incidence of referral for visual problems, but nothing was really predictive of the alcohol exposure.
Ed, is this a clinical population?
Yeah.
Because I know we've discussed this. That's been the question raised by Stromlund's data, is that she has a very high percentage of ocular problems because it's a referral, not even just a clinical, but a referral population to ophthalmologists that she mostly dealt with when she developed her numbers. And
right.
This paper sounds like it's a little bit less problematic in terms of the ascertainment of the cohort?
These were school children, I think, under the age of 11, who had a diagnosis primarily of partial FAS.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, 65% of where they're recommending referrals using standard criteria for ophthalmological referrals is pretty high. It's normally around 10 to 20%.
Right.
School-age sample. And, you know, all the FAS kids, for example, had good color vision. That wasn't an issue with them, but they had amblyopia. A high percentage of them had that. So, you know, knowing that eye defect didn't tell you anything about their exposure. And there were other problems that I can't answer a lot of questions because the details weren't in the paper. But Kirsten does great work, and she has access to, you know, populations that we don't have access to, and so that's certainly a consideration. You know, we tried to set Kirsten up in Russia. We brought one of those cameras into Russia, and we just never could get it going because, despite the fact that I had to drink 4 vodkas with the head of the ophthalmological hospital before noontime one day, because it was his birthday, never got it working. So the camera sat there it was a donated camera in the Swedish embassy in Russia for years.
So let me just offer something, which is that we have a very robust ocular telehealth program. It was developed at this medical center, and it's now been implemented across the VA nationally. It is pretty easy and not nearly as expensive as with the other cameras to send technicians out to take pictures of eyes. We have,
we're doing it in shopping malls, I believe, right?
Anywhere. I mean, we do it in remote clinics in northern Maine or in Hawaii or all over the place. The whole idea was to be able to, this was developed for diabetic retinopathy, but it's now been validated also for macular degeneration. But you certainly see the optic fundus really well. And maybe this is an opportunity for a developmental project, which is to get a few cameras, send them out into the field, and send them to a reading center. I'm not offering ours. We can't do that kind of thing, but there are people who are trained to look at these things. It would at least give you population-based information on a large number of people. And since we're doing population-based studies in some of the programs, it might be helpful to add this if it's considered a reasonably high priority.
How complicated are the cameras, Mike?
They're not that complicated, and they train technicians to take the pictures in the field.
Are they expensive?
I can get you the information.
I mean, that might be something we could send along with the 3D camera.
Yeah.
Do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Somebody needs to know how to use it. That's the thing. We do train people to do it, and I can get the details of what's involved. But this could answer a question with relatively little effort and not having to send Kirsten around the world.
Right.
Well, yeah, and that would be good. But Leah goes with the camera very often, you know, so we could train Leah, and she's taking the pictures now, and she went to South Africa. She goes out to Los Angeles to do it. She went to Minnesota. So, I mean, it'd be one way where we'd have diagnosable cases that have been seen by Ken. And we could get, you know, a reasonable number of images.
It'd give you at least a very good fundus photograph that's good enough for diagnosing a couple of major conditions and certainly would allow you to do something semi-quantitative about the optic disc, which is one of the areas that she's identified.
Yeah, and in a non-referred population. So.
Correct. That would be really important, although it sounds like somebody, well, it's not quite the same because the paper you reviewed sounds like it's kids with already a diagnosis.
Yeah, they were already diagnosed.
But nonetheless.
And they didn't do fundal photos. So.
Yeah.
All right, we could maybe bring that up again on the clinical call.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Well, I'll talk to some of you at 10 o'clock.
Hold on. This is Jill. I have one quick comment. Because there is going to be such a timeline kind of moving forward, would having something like a Google Calendar where things are listed be helpful, or is that just another thing for you guys to look at? Is email the best? What's your thoughts on that?
I prefer email.
Okay.
I don't know how other people feel. I don't look at Google documents or anything like that until someone tells me to do it.
All right, email it is.
I think working out a timeline and just sending it to folks is a good idea.
Okay.
All righty. All right, everyone. Thank you very much, and I'll talk to some of you at 10.
Very good.
Thanks, Ed.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Hi.
Michael?
Yes?
I'd like to talk to you. Can we...